From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The nation's first primary is tomorrow in New Hampshire. It's a full-on fight between those who won in Iowa, Obama and Huckabee, and the other fierce contenders for their party's nominations. Here to flesh things out a bit, we've got Ron Elving. He is NPR's senior Washington editor. Hey, Ron.
Hello, Farai.
So
good to be with you.
It's great to have you on. What's going on in New Hampshire today?
New Hampshire today is unseasonably warm. It has a gray overcast, and it has a lot of candidates campaigning as though their lives depended on it. And we have, I think, a highly emotionally charged situation on the Democratic side, where the crowds following Obama around the state are not only setting records, but they are also reaching extraordinarily high peaks of emotionality in some of these events. The candidate is clearly energized by this. It's really driving him to new heights of oratory. At the same time, you have an almost tragic sense around the Clinton campaign, where the sudden demotion of the previous front runner has clearly had a huge impact on the campaigners around her, her staff, her longtime loyalists, her family, which has been traveling with her, of course, Chelsea and former President Bill Clinton. And today, just about an hour ago, at her event, Senator Clinton actually seemed to begin to weep at one point when she was imploring her supporters to stay with her, imploring people to compare her qualifications for office with those of Senator Obama, and really bringing this to a very personal degree of importance to herself and to her supporters. So this has really been quite an emotional morning in the New Hampshire campaign, with the first votes to be cast tomorrow morning.
That sounds incredibly dramatic. What other tones and textures have you found in New Hampshire in terms of, for example, has Senator Obama and has Governor Huckabee, have they been crowing out their victory, or what has been the tone of any of their engagements?
Well, I think on the Republican side, you see quite a different dynamic playing out, because the people who boosted Mike Huckabee to his victory in Iowa are largely absent here. That is to say, the demographic group, the evangelical Christians who were so important to him in Iowa and who made up, in fact, a very large proportion of the entire Republican vote in Iowa and went very heavily for the governor. There are not quite so many people who so identify themselves here in New Hampshire, and there has been some resentment among New Hampshire Republicans in general at the suggestion that they would, like the Iowa Republicans, flock to this Baptist minister from Arkansas. They haven't. He has stayed right where he was in the polls, about 11-12% in most of the polls, and that puts him right about on a par with Libertarian Ron Paul and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and a little bit ahead of Fred Thompson. He is not a factor here. The real competition on the Republican side is still between John McCain and Mitt Romney, Mitt, of course, being the former governor of neighboring Massachusetts, John McCain being the guy who won the primary here by big numbers in 2000 over George W. Bush. So those guys are a couple of big heavyweights in New Hampshire, and they're going at it a hammer and tong, and I think it's seen as a place where John McCain needs to win, or his campaign really will not launch itself in 2008.
You mentioned some of the differences between Iowans and folks from New Hampshire. Evangelical Christianity not so big in New Hampshire. Would you describe the New Hampshire conservatives as more fiscal conservatives?
They have been traditionally more of a fiscal conservative. Of course, the state motto is live free or die. They have had historically low taxes, no income tax. The state has tried very hard to maintain a stand on its own image, the granite state, the self-reliant, rock-ribbed New England image. And that really has been accurate, especially in describing the Republican Party here in New Hampshire through many generations of its history. But it's changing as more and more people move up here from the cities of New England, from New York, from Boston, and as more people from the rest of the country discover it and move here. There really is a rather large retirement community here, so you run into more and more people who chose to come here in their later years. It's not the New Hampshire that our fathers and grandfathers knew, politically or demographically or sociologically. So the Republican Party is changing too, and we're seeing some of that play out in this confrontation.
Should we be looking ahead to more negative attacks? I'm thinking specifically this weekend ABC hosted Democrats and Republicans for debates, and there seemed to be a lot more attacks. Should we expect more of that in the future?
Sadly, yes. I think that this is a big part of our politics. Some people call politics war by other means. Sometimes it's going to get tough. Sometimes it's going to get nasty. Some of this will, of course, take the form of what are called comparison ads, where one candidate or the other lays out his or her positions and then says, but that's not what my opponent says. He says something else quite different. And we have that sort of invidious comparison. Other times, of course, it can be even more direct when someone questions the morals or questions the honesty or the integrity of his or her opponent. And I think we'll see more of that before we're done, and on both sides, quite possibly.
Well, Ron, thanks for the update.
My pleasure, Farai. Good to be with you.
We've been speaking with Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor, and he joined us from our election studios in New Hampshire. Your neighbors might be taking down those holiday lights now and getting hit with the electric bills later. It's like that for a lot of us these days. First you play, then you pay. But economist Keith Reed has some ideas for how to get off on the good foot this year. He's a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and he has just launched BET's personal finance blog, Dollar Out of 15 Cents. Hey, Keith.
What's up, Farai?
Well, what's up is reality check. You know, it's time to take a look at what's left in the wallet. How do you start off on the right foot in terms of savings, for example?
I think one of the things that people should have done before you even start to talk about getting off on the right foot this year in terms of savings was look at what you did last year. If you've got those receipts that are still left, or the bills that are coming due, really look at what you spent last year. Really look at how much of a consumer you were during the holiday season and figure out what you can do to cut back your spending in some areas that you didn't necessarily need to spend. That would be one of the first things. I mean, one of the biggest things that I think a lot of people don't do anymore or aren't as disciplined about as they should be is budgeting. You really have to sit down, look at what you're bringing in every month or every other week or however often it is that you get paid, and figure out what you're spending. Take a pen and a piece of paper with you outside when you go to work or when you're shopping on the weekends, and write down everything that you spent, all the little things that you don't keep track of. Figure out where that money is going and start to work backwards from there to see what you can cut out of your budget so that you can be more disciplined and not end up owing in the new year as much as you may have owed in the prior year. That would be the number one place I would start for most folks.
What about actual savings plans? You can get such low interest rates on money that you just keep in a savings account that's linked to your checking account. What other options do you have if you don't want to have your money tied up for a long time, but you do want to get some money in terms of interest?
One of the great things you can do is obviously look into an online savings account. Two of the most popular accounts that are out there are ING Direct's Orange account and HSBC Direct is an online subsidiary of HSBC Bank, where you can go online, you can have a direct deposit or an automatic deposit set up to come out of either your paycheck or your checking account, link that to your online account. Those banks, because they don't have physical branches, they don't have the overhead, so they pass those savings on in overhead from running a branch onto you in the form of higher interest rates. Right now, I think both of those banks are giving in the 4%, maybe even 5% range, and sometimes for new accounts, you can get APYs that are a little bit higher than even 4 or 5%. Sometimes you'll find promotions that go as high as close to 6% on the money that you put into some of those accounts. And it's a very good way to save your money. The other thing that's great about those things is that when you put the money in, because it doesn't come with an ATM card, it's a little bit more difficult to get access to the money. So, for example, if you have an ING account, if you put money into that account, it takes at least 3 days for the money to come back to you if you need to transfer it into a checking account that you have access to. So in those 3 days, you've got a little bit of time to think. It's not money that you can just go get and make an impulse purchase with. So those are two really, really good vehicles for putting some money away. The other thing that you want to start to do is look at where you are in your 401k. You can put as much as 25% of your income in some instances into a 401k. You want to look at your company's match, or do you have enough money in that 401k to take advantage of the match that you're making? Did you make enough of a contribution to your IRA? All of those things. And again, start with looking at what you've actually budgeted. Some of the money that you take out of your budget from discretionary spending, you should immediately start to put towards savings.
All right. tax man cometh. Not right now, but you are closing out the books on 1 year. And suppose that you're someone who says, all right, well, I'm going to get a jump. It's not going to be April 12th and me sitting around covered in papers and crying and, you know, calling to a higher power to get me out of this fix. What can you do now to keep you from that situation?
Start right now getting organized. Really, again, sit down, take a look at some of the spending that you did last year. Where are some of the areas that some of the things that you spent may be tax write-off? Do you have all of the receipts that you use for things for your home? For example, if you're a homeowner, did you keep the receipts for all of the maintenance that you did on your home? Look at some of the things that you may be able to write off, that expenses that you paid in for work. Did you drive a certain number of miles for work that you didn't get reimbursed for? Did you spend money on equipment or things that you needed for your job that the job didn't expense you for, reimburse you for? You may be able to write some of that stuff off on your taxes. Do you maintain a home office? Some of that space you might be able to write off on your taxes if you are a renter, but you use one room dedicated in your home as an office. Keep the receipts. Keep track of all of the things that you're spending and start to look at what some of the tax rules are. One very important thing, I wrote about this last year. There is a movement that we don't hear very much about, but there's a movement around the country to get people to take advantage of the earned income tax credit. It's a tax credit that applies to a very narrow section of taxpayers in the United States. It tends to be people who are working parents, people who are working but don't make a ton of money in their parents. You need to check whether or not you qualify for the earned income tax credit and make sure that if you do, that you take advantage of it, both at the federal and many states have a matching tax credit to go along with that federal tax credit.
All right, Keith. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Keith Reed is a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and his new finance blog for BET is called Dollar Out of 15 Cents. He joined me from member station WGUC in Cincinnati, Ohio. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Has there ever been a better time to be a black blogger? First of all, this election around, your grandma might actually know what your blog is and where to sign up for your RSS feed. Second, well, there's nothing like a presidential race that includes a black man, a white woman, a Mormon, a Catholic, and an evangelical Christian to give you fodder for your opinion pieces. Today, we'll dig into Barack Obama's win in Iowa and what could happen in New Hampshire tomorrow, plus lots, lots more. On deck, we've got Rob Redding, publisher of the ReddingNewsReview.com. Ed Brown, who writes the blog Dark Star Spouts Off, and Jay Smooth, who video blogs at illdoctrine.com. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello, Farai.
So this is quite a year. Jay, start us out. What is, has anything changed since Obama won in Iowa?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, certainly this campaign as a whole is forcing all Americans to ask themselves the question, are we ready, in a more concrete way than we ever have before? And certainly Iowa, a lily-white state going for Obama, could give us hope that Americans might be ready to answer yes to that question. But I'm worried about us having too much irrational exuberance on that, because in an Iowa caucus, we're still speaking in theoretical terms. And I wonder if Obama, or Hillary for that matter, became the nominee. I think at that point, that'll be the true test of America's stamina for keeping up this tolerance. And I think it's still possible that we'll see what they call the Bradley effect or the Wilder effect, that some of those votes might drop off towards the end. But it's difficult to say. I mean, a lot of people say Obama is perceived differently than previous black candidates because of his background and so on. So, I mean, I'm fascinated to see how it will play out.
Ed, there was a piece in the Associated Press ran over the weekend that said that voters are colorblind, basically. Do you agree with that?
I'd have to say no. There have been races like in the Baltimore area where, like for Martin O'Malley, when he ran for governor, 95% of the white voters voted for him, and it turned out that only 30% of the black voters voted for him, and the other 70% were dispersed over the other candidates. So maybe while black people are more likely to say, hey, I'm going to vote for this person because he's black, and now evidently I'm not going to vote for this person just because he is black, I think white voters are more, secretive about their plans, and they do what they do, once the curtain string is pulled, rather.
Rob, what do you think?
Well, I think that not much has changed about race in America. Coming from the South, from Atlanta, it's really important to remember that the KKK still exists and that their skinheads still exist and that people are racist in less overt ways. So I think that when he gets south, it will be interesting. South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, Louisiana, those will be tough places for him to win. I mean, we're talking about the North here. We're talking about Iowa. I actually spent 4 weeks in Iowa. And actually, the Iowans, they're some of the nicest people you ever want to meet, really. And I was actually taken a little bit off guard by it because I expected it to be a little bit more, especially since they have such a low black population, a little bit more uncomfortable. But I felt very comfortable in Iowa. So I don't think that that is the litmus test for the rest of the nation at this point.
Do you think that there is a situation, and I'll start with you, Rob, but I want to get everyone's opinion, where there are some African-American voters who are saying, you know what, I don't know if this man can pull it off, even if I support him on a policy level, even if I support the idea of there being America's first black president, I just don't trust that this can happen. Is there kind of a group of African-Americans who just can't believe that he's still doing well?
Yes, there is. There's a group out there that supports Hillary Clinton. As a matter of fact, that group is a little bit, I think, kind of dumbfounded as to how she's sunk in the polls so quickly. And I think, and one of the things I talk about in the podcast that I recorded on the website and I want to share with you is that I think that Karl Rove and some of the Republicans have a hand here in making sure Hillary Clinton looks real bad in the early going to make sure she does kind of drop out. I mean, we see that in the conservative media already. So I think that there is a plan, a concerted effort here to make Obama the candidate, although he beats their candidate head to head, their candidates head to head in every single poll, I think they have somebody something on Barack Obama.
Ed, what about that? I mean, do you think that at this point that, I mean, there's always operatives from both parties that are closely watching the race. Do you think that there's a possibility that Republican operatives or on the other side, Democrats, could actually be putting their hands in the party primaries thus far?
Thus far, I'd have to say no. It's a nice conspiracy theory, but I can't get into that one right now because there are so many races coming along down the line, and anybody who think that they know Hillary Clinton should know that she's a fighter, and she's going to take it down to the wire. And I think what should be watched by a lot of black Democrats, I'm an independent, by the way, I just became a Republican just to vote against Giuliani in the primary, but I think what black Democrats need to watch is how the Democrat Party responds. I mean, frankly, I don't think that the Democrat Party is really as friendly to blacks as a lot of blacks think. So when Hillary gets down, as she is now, as she gets down after Tuesday, you know, watch what comes out of the Democrat Party and watch what comes out of the mainstream newspapers. They are really going to light Obama up.
Jay, do you think that there are a lot more voters like Ed who are dissatisfied with both parties, and where are those voters going?
Well, certainly we saw in Iowa a lot of new voters came into the process, apparently inspired by the new voices and diversity we have in the race. But I think that's hopefully what will offset people who might not be ready, quote unquote, is bringing in new energy from people who didn't feel like there was a reason to be part of the process. And I think it's a tough road to hoe because I think, people like Obama especially seems to have the swagger of a radical but the policies of a moderate in a lot of ways. So I think it might be a challenge to reach those people who have been disillusioned by the process, but I think it's still possible to do it.
Well, folks, I want to reintroduce what we're doing and who we're doing it with. You are listening to NPR's News and Notes. I am Farai Chidea. We have a bloggers roundtable, and with us, we were just hearing from Jay Smooth, who video blogs at illdoctrine.com. We've also got Ed Brown, who writes the blog Dark Star Spouts Off, and Rob Redding, publisher of the readingnewsreview.com. Let's move on to talk about something that's going on in black radio or in radio, period, with an African-American focus. The urban broadcaster Radio 1 is ending its relationship with XM's Channel 169, The Power, as of tomorrow. At least that's what the Reading New Review is reporting. All of XM's weekend shows and all of its weekday programming after 4 o'clock aren't going to come from Radio 1 anymore. They've had Al Sharpton, Joe Madison, other stars remain on XM. Rob, what is going on in your mind here? What's the question here of distribution and content?
Well, this is an issue where I think the black listeners out there to talk radio, and there are very few black listeners to talk radio, but they're very loyal listeners to talk radio. But it's growing by the day here in terms of the listeners. But I think that they will be served well by this change, the fact that you have XM taking over this channel. They'll definitely put a program director in place that's full-time. That's something radio hadn't done, right? In addition to that, they'll bring in more talent. They'll pay that talent a considerable sum of money to hopefully provide programming. So this will also help in their attempt to capture this whole merger deal from the FCC. So this is going to be important for that.
So you are on Joe Madison's show quite a bit, and so you are staying on XM. I want to move on to Ed. Ed, do you think that this is a question, you know, Radio 1 has been this stalwart mega broadcaster, broadcasting empire among African Americans. Do you think that this deal-making and deal-breaking shows that, powers like Radio 1 are really trying to figure out how to reach African Americans in the new millennium? Is the shakeup a good thing, a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing because they tried and they failed, and hopefully they learned some lessons from it. But I think the bigger issue is, to me, still is, will satellite radio really succeed or not? It may contract further to only one player, but then, you know, I'm in, you know, the Baltimore-Washington corridor, so, you know, I don't necessarily have to listen to XM radio or satellite radio because I have so many choices, and that includes talk radio. It was a nice try, and maybe they need to, you know, after they get their financial house in order, you know, figure it all out and try it again. But, you know, this time really put some real money behind it. They're doing a great job with TV One. I just feel that with the radio, the XM radio, they just didn't, you know, go at it as strongly.
Jay, what about the broader picture for media that targets African Americans? You have a kind of this chiasmus effect where you have certain institutional names in black media. I'm thinking particularly a lot of the African American newspapers that are losing audience over time, losing a black audience to mainstream or white-run institutions. Then you have some places that had been identified as black properties, whether they're black-owned or not, like BET, that have huge white audiences. What do people want in terms of media that addresses specific racial communities? Can you even draw any lessons about what people are gravitating towards?
Well, it's hard to tell because, especially in radio, I think radio's role in our life has been shrinking across the board, due mostly to the revolution in new technology and internet and digital media. I mean, especially in music radio, the two things that radio provided was, it used to provide expertise. You went to your favorite DJ because you knew he would take you on a musical journey nobody could. Then more recently, you go to radio for convenience. You turn on the commercial music station and you know it's going to play the same 10 hits every 2 hours. And as far as convenience, you can't beat the internet when it comes to convenience. And as far as expertise, whatever topic or music you want to explore, there's 1,000 blogs and message boards you can go to for that now. And you can build your own radio station on your iPod, download News and Notes, download the new Nas album, and program it however you want. So I think it's going to be a challenge, no matter what your niche is, to remain relevant in radio right now. It might be a little bit easier in talk.
It sounds a little bit like what you're saying is that radio content is still going to exist, but it's not going to necessarily be something everyone gets on a radio.
I think that's quite possible. I mean, I think satellite radio was hoping that the convenience of having their software and their hardware pre-installed in automobiles would provide a more convenient way to listen to music than through internet and digital means. But I think, you know, I think it remains to be seen. I think the trick may be providing radio online and in other forms other than on terrestrial radio frequencies.
I want to jump into one last topic. Every few months we hear about a notable discrimination case. Now the nation's largest defense contractor has made the largest settlement ever to one person. It's Lockheed Martin. It agreed to a racial harassment settlement of $2.5 million. The money went to one man, Charles Daniels, African American. Now, the question in my mind is really, every time you have one of these big settlements, obviously it's good. It's vindication for the person who gets the money. But does it change the game? Rob, does it change the game when a corporation has to ante up? Does it mean that that corporation eliminates bias in the workplace? And more importantly, does it mean that corporations in general get a message like, this is not acceptable, this is our bottom line, we're going to have to change our policies?
No, it doesn't change the game. It's good that he received or is receiving this sum of money, and we report on this day in and day out, these types of instances of racism, these types of settlements. I think that it results in folks losing their jobs, them seeing job cuts and restrictions at jobs on spending, et cetera. I think, though, that this is necessary. This is something that we have to see within the private sector. The private sector has to be responsible for the way it treats blacks and all minorities in general. If I can real quickly come back and with the Radio 1 article, one last piece on that is that I don't think Radio 1 had an opportunity really or did what they should have done with 169. I think that at the end of the day, with Radio 1, what they had to have done in the case of XM 169 is they had to create a different product. And unfortunately, Radio 1 has been a terrestrial-based company. So I don't think they ever had an intent of actually making it a success, so I'm glad to see XM taking it over.
All right. Well, I'm going to move back to this discrimination topic. Ed, what about changing the game? If settlements don't change the game, what would?
Honestly, I don't think the only thing that can change the game is, you know, the change in people's hearts over the long term. I've seen it. I've seen the lawsuits change the game temporarily, you know, but then after a while, you know, when people forget, I've seen things where they can go back to where it was before until something else happens. And to me, that's okay. You know, that's life.
In your own experience, if you have ever been faced with something that you view as racially inappropriate, and I think most people have, certainly most black people, what do you do about it? Do you just suck it up? Do you write a note? Even if you haven't faced that, what would be your gut about what to do in a situation?
You know, what I did in the past was, you know, I brought it to that person's attention in my immediate management and, you know, let them handle it. You know, I just said, hey, this is what happened. I don't appreciate it. Went to my manager. This is what happened. I don't appreciate it. This is why, you know, and now do something. But then after that, you know, it didn't happen again. So, yeah, I left it alone. I think it depends on the type of level of harassment, you know, that I'm going through is whether or not I would say, you know what, forget it, I'm out of here, or you know what, I have to make this company pay, so let's go the EEOC route or the lawsuit route.
Jay, have you ever had to make a choice about whether to bring something up or not?
Well, I'm in kind of a unique position because my parents are mixed, my father is black, my mother's white, and I self-identify as black, but people perceive me as being various things at various times, so it hasn't happened that much in the workplace, but I often get a window into what people are thinking when their guard is down as far as racial issues. And when later on in another conversation they discover that I'm black, you can see their face go blank as they mull over every conversation we ever had previously to remember if they said something they shouldn't have said. But I've been fortunate never to have to confront that in the workplace. But I think it is important for people to take the risk of stepping up and documenting and complaining. And, you know, you have to have the stamina to keep pushing through, because if you look at the details of this Lockheed Martin case, management knew about it for a long time and failed to act over a period of months and maybe years. And, it's just, if you need proof that the Iowa caucus doesn't mean we've made it to the promised land, look at the details of the Lockheed Martin case, and you'll see we've still got a long way to go. So I think we need to have the courage to keep fighting on those things.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thanks so much.
Thank you,
Farah.
Jay Smooth video blogs at illdoctrine.com. He joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. Rob Redding publishes the Redding News Review, an online news site. He joined us from Doppler Studios in Atlanta. And Ed Brown blogs at Dark Star Spouts Off. He joined us from Columbia, Maryland. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. The hit HBO series The Wire kicked off its fifth and final season last night. It's set in my hometown of Baltimore, on the corner, around the way, And in City Hall, the police precincts, local schools, and this season, the newspaper office. I spoke with two actors from the series. In a moment, we'll meet Jamie Hector, who plays a rising drug dealer, but first, actress Felicia Snoop Pearson. On The Wire, she plays an androgynous street corner killer. Last season, Snoop got all hot and bothered about a nail gun. We're not talking about one of those Home Improvement show moments. She used the nail gun to entomb bodies in an abandoned brownstone. And in this scene, she found the perfect tool.
If you want to shoot nails, this is the Cadillac, man. This is gunpowder activated, 27 caliber, full auto, no kickback, nail-throwing mayhem, man. This right here is tight.
Felicia Snoop Pearson's character on the show is called Snoop. And like her character, the real Snoop used to deal drugs and was even sent up for killing a woman. Her new memoir is Grace After Midnight. We got a chance to talk to her about The Wire and her book. She was at a nightclub when one of the actors on the show, Michael K. Williams, told her she should be on the small screen.
I didn't know who Michael K. was. He came to me, you know, and asked me, was I a girl or boy? And I said, I'm a girl. He was like, wow. And, you know, he was like, they had a script for a guy, you know, and he was like, forget that. I want you to come to see the writers and the producers and all that. And the next day he called me. I came. They said they were going to send me out for an audition. I auditioned, and here I am.
And at the time that Michael came up to you and told you about coming on the show and tried to recruit you to come on the show, where were you on that line between leading the straight and narrow life in terms of where you got your finances from and going into crime, which you had done before?
I was still on the corners. I was still on the corners.
Doing what?
Selling drugs.
You know, Baltimore, which is my hometown, so much runs through Baltimore in terms of the drug trade. There's a lot of supply. What made you good at what you did?
I mean, because I know the streets, you know, and then I went and tried to get a job. You know, I had three jobs. And like I said, in Grace After Midnight, every time I turned around, they kept firing me. So what else can I turn to? The streets will never let you down. That's sad to say, but, you know, what I supposed to be starving, go to a shelter, you know, because they fired me like, no, because you're a criminal background.
You went to jail for killing someone. In self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever wish that you could go back in time?
And every day.
Every day?
Every day.
Tell us about the title, Grace After Midnight. How did that come about?
Grace After Midnight. I got midnight from my past. You know, it was like, it wasn't no coming from out of that. You know, it wasn't no break. And as soon as it get dark around my way, that's when a lot of things go off, a lot of things pop off. Grace is right now that I'm trying to bless another kid with the opportunity that I'm getting right now with something. And just to let people know, you can make it through your trials and tribulations, even though it just seems so gloomy, But you can make it out of.
What does grace mean to you?
Grace means what I'm doing now. Everything.
Now that you are on television playing a character with the same name that you have, do you feel that there's a private Snoop and a public Snoop, or do you feel like all of it is just laid out on TV? Do you have a private life, I guess?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm.
The character Snoop that I play on The Wire is nothing like the real Snoop at all. You know, I had the character Snoop don't cares about nothing. The character Snoop listens to Marlo. The real Snoop don't listen to nobody. The real Snoop, she has a kind and loving heart that give her last dollar to anybody, you know? I mean, it's a difference. It's a totally difference.
When you think about this show ending, what's next? You've written a book, been on TV, very popular character. What lies ahead for you?
More movies, more whatever that comes my way. You know, I don't know what the future holds, but I know I'm in it.
Well, Snoop, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
the author of the memoir Grace After Midnight, Felicia Snoop Pearson. She plays a character by the same name on HBO's TV series The Wire. And The Wire's been praised for the accuracy of its characters, whether they're cops, reporters, politicos, or gangsters. Take Marlo Stanfield, a ruthless drug dealer who still cares for a few folks.
All I'm saying, if I'm going to take your package, the split need be fair. I mean, I got to pay all my people the same, and here you open the price on me.
Pay your people less.
They my people, though.
Actor Jamie Hector explains how he sees the character he plays.
Marlo is a very disciplined businessman, economic sociopath. You know, he's a cat on the streets that just has an advantage over others because he just basically like has no heart, but he has heart for those that he loves that are around him.
In the first episode of the season, you'll see him holding court over a group of friends and frenemies, including one played by Method Man. What does it take for your character, Marlo, to stand in front of a group of people and try to hold them down, hold them to order?
In his situation, murder. And it takes also taking care of them. Really, that really plays a huge part, being able to take care of those that stand around him.
You know, The Wire has been highly praised for bringing together, weaving together all these different parts of city life. And it's very specific about Baltimore, but it also says a lot about cities in general, where you have the government, you have the underground, you have the police officers. And as this series matures and as this series, frankly, reaches its end, you see that every hierarchy has its problems. The police hierarchy is going through its problems. The government hierarchy is going through its problems. And the criminals are going through their own problems.
Yes, indeed.
In a way, this show is about power. What did you learn about power being on the show?
That everybody's trying to get it. Not everybody's going to achieve it. But at the same time, you know, those that decide to stick to the script may somewhat achieve it at times, but everybody tends to try to break the rules a little bit. And as far as, like, juking the stats, as you've seen in the... I mean, you've seen that throughout the entire, all the five, every season so far. The police, they juke the stats in order to get what they may want, and the Board of Education. And everybody's trying to get power and trying to get recognized and trying to make a difference, but at the same time, the powers that be don't allow it. So I learned, basically, that everybody really, really would like to get power, but it's just a fine line between getting power and staying legal.
Now, the cast also has evolved over different seasons, and this final season is your third season. What have you learned about working with a tight group of people who...
Oh, you know, I learned a lot. You know, you surround yourself with what you want to be best at, and you hopefully become that. Working with Sonia, working with Felicia, working with Benga, working with Idris and Wood, and as well as behind the scenes, Ed and David and Nina. I learned how to be a better person. I learned how to be a better actor also. And, you know, I learned how to take what they have and apply it to what I have, which will fine-tune everything that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Has there ever been a moment where you're like, yeah, I'm glad you think that, but that's not how I'm going to play this scene?
No, you know, funny thing about it is, they hire you and they expect that you would know how to deliver. So, I mean, I work on what I have to work on before I come to the scene so I understand what's going on before and after, inside, under, and on top.
The Wire has been put together by some people with very different, very interesting backgrounds, people with backgrounds in media, law enforcement, even on the other side of law enforcement. I understand that you talked with Melvin Williams, who was a drug dealer, and talked to him about your role. What did you learn from that interaction?
When I spoke to Melvin about the role, he told me some interesting things. And one thing that he said to me was, remember, when you make money, be aware that somebody's always trying to take it. So always keep an eye on your dollar. And he also, I mean, he told me so many things. He basically, it wasn't more so what he said. It was more so how he moved. That was very interesting.
What do you mean by that?
He studied martial arts. He understood how to stay still. One time we were shooting out in Baltimore, and it was very hot outside. And, you know, people tend to act up when it gets hot. In other words, they can't stand still. They fidget. They want to take their clothes off. And he simply said, the art to mastering this is just be still. And he didn't crack. He didn't break a sweat. And it was, I mean, extremely humid. And it was hot. You know, I mean, it was just very uncomfortable. And his art to that was simply just to be still. And that's my first introduction to Melvin, is one time when I went into, I came on set and I was going to my trailer, And there he, and I went into the wrong trailer. I actually opened the door, and there he was laying in the dark, lights off, and just laying there with his hand leaning on his fist and just looking at the door. And I was like, oh, excuse me. He's like, don't worry about it, young blood. And I just shut the door. So that was my first introduction to him, his stillness. And that's more of an example for me as my way to approach the character than hearing somebody talk all day.
You also have a lot of other things going on. You have a clothing line.
Yes.
And you're going to be on Heroes, which is such a highly acclaimed show. It doesn't seem like after The Wire ends, you're going to be unemployed. Tell me a little bit more about what your plans are.
Yeah, well, you know what? I started a clothing line called Royal Addiction. Opened a store in Brooklyn and Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn, 463 Tompkins. And it's a trendy line, and it's a line that I enjoy because I enjoy dressing. I've always enjoyed it, you know, putting sneakers together with the outfit. And the way I dress, I'm sure people would also enjoy it also. For instance, Marlo, his character, people enjoy watching him to see what he's going to wear. As far as Heroes go, yeah, it's huge, and I enjoy that also. I'm playing a character named Benjamin Knox Washington. And we began shooting, and it's fun because it's so much going on behind the scenes as far as sci-fi, so to speak, action. I mean, the minute I got on set, it was complete action. Behind the scenes, throwing people, punching people, just up and down, in and out. And it's just that's another challenge in itself because, you know, when you're acting, you know, you tend to do so much drama at times that you love to get into like an active sport and just exercise everything that you know. And I'm a martial artist, and I have the opportunity to apply that.
Sounds like you got a lot on your plate, Jamie.
Yes, indeed.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Jamie Hector plays Marlo Stanfield on HBO's critically acclaimed The Wire. Yesterday, the show kicked off its fifth and final season. It was all over the headlines last week, Barack Obama's historic win in the Iowa Democratic caucus. The Illinois senator still has a long way to go before he's even considered to be a final choice for the presidency. But a lot of folks, including many black Americans, have started taking Obama more seriously since his win. Commentator Afi Odelia Scruggs says seeing a black man do so well so early in the race got her dreaming about the possibilities.
On the night of Barack Obama's victory in Iowa's Democratic caucus, I picked up the telephone and called my great aunt. She's the one in her 80s. She's the one who lives in Chicago. She's the one who, like me, stays up all night long reading and watching the news. Aunt Martha, I said, we might actually see a black president in our lifetime. What did you say? She asked. I repeated myself because I'd started to cry. Now, I'd been talking to relatives all night. I come from a family of yellow dog Democrats. My sister is a teacher and an activist. She weighs candidates by their stance on education issues and on No Child Left Behind. With her, I talked practicalities. Could Obama beat Huckabee? Could Obama overcome the hostility and bigotry that often hamstrings overqualified African-American candidates? But I wanted to talk wonder and hope, so I called my aunt. Together, we savored Obama's triumph and considered its implications. Did you see all those white people at his victory speech, she said? Yeah, I answered. Obama picked up votes in a state where only 2.5% of the population is African American. What could we say? This is what our ancestors hoped for, I said. This is history, she replied. Who would know better than she? Aunt Martha was born in Nashville, Tennessee. She came up during the years when Jim Crow was strangling African American hopes and destroying black people's accomplishments. Yet she'd finished high school and college. In 1942, when she and her sister displayed their college diplomas, They started a family tradition that would continue for three generations. She had experienced oppression and, to some measure, defeated it. And she'd left a legacy for us to uphold. I was born in 1954, 5 months after the Brown v. Board ruling. If my Aunt Martha lived a life filled with limitations, I've lived a life of potential to be achieved. She sat in segregated classrooms. I sat in barely integrated ones. She'd seen African Americans barred from voting unless they could pay a dollar poll tax. I'd seen African Americans run into a booth, cast a ballot, and hurry to the next errand. She'd seen 80 years of struggles and victories. I'd seen 50 years of accomplishments and setbacks. But it seemed we could both witness an achievement we dared to dream about. When we talked, her voice was joyful and confident. I was the one in tears. I was humbled. I was crying for her generation and the ones before it. I was crying for my aunt, my grandmother, and those in the twilight of their years. They could look back over bitter experiences and smile just a little. Because Obama won the Iowa caucus. Because, just for a night, we had overcome.
Why should I feel discouraged? Why should the shadows fall?
Afee Odelia Scruggs is an independent journalist, writer, and digital storyteller who lives in Cleveland, Ohio. And that's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Upon a broken guitar.